Today is Thursday, June 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, protests in America have become more peaceful, but police violence is up.
It's something that you see in authoritarian states in different parts of the world, and it's something that does not belong on the streets of the United States of America.
Plus, Australia locks down its ski resorts over coronavirus fears, but the European Union plans to end COVID-19 travel restrictions by end of June. Those stories and more are next. The outcry for justice for George Floyd, an African-American man who was killed while in police custody in Minneapolis, continued across the U.S. Thursday evening, but demonstrations were marked by fewer incidents of violence by protesters. VOA's Penny Dixon reports.
Unlike previous days, protests were largely peaceful in the United States Thursday evening, including in New York City, where demonstrations over the death of George Floyd lasted beyond an 8 p.m. curfew. Earlier Thursday, George Floyd was remembered as a devoted father and family man in Minneapolis in the first of several memorial services, where civil rights leader the Reverend Al Sharpton made an appeal to all Americans with a reference to the white police officer kneeling on Floyd's neck as he cried out he could not breathe.
What happened to Floyd happens every day in this country, in education, in health services, and in every area of American life. It's time for us to stand up in George's name and say, get your knee off our necks.
The officer who pressed his knee on Floyd's neck is facing second-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Three other officers, including one who helped restrain Floyd, face charges of being complicit in the killing. Floyd's funeral service will be held Tuesday in his hometown of Houston. Sharpton at the Thursday memorial said he is organizing a march on Washington to be held August 28th, 57 years after Martin Luther King Jr. led a march and made history with his iconic I Have a Dream speech, an address filled with the message of equality for people of all races, creeds, and religions. Penny Dixon, VOA News.
Although the demonstrations have been more peaceful, the police response in many American cities appears to be more violent. On social media, hundreds of videos have surfaced, apparently showing police brutalizing protesters, often attacking nonviolent demonstrators with batons, tear gas, and pepper spray without any apparent provocation. In one particularly graphic video, a police officer in the city of Buffalo, New York, appears to shove an elderly man to the ground, who hits his head on the concrete, becomes unconscious, and bleeds out of his head. Numerous police then walk past his body without helping while protesters scream for help. There have also been videos apparently showing police threatening people with guns, trampling them with horses, and attempting to drive vehicles through crowds of protesters. The combination of police violence against protesters across the country and U.S. President Donald Trump's threat to crush the protests with the military have led the human rights watchdog Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect to release an atrocity alert for the United States for the first time. For more, I spoke to the center's executive director, Simon Adams, and here's what he had to say.
We've never written about the United States before in our weekly atrocity alert bulletin. This was the first time. And it's, you know, and while the murder of George Floyd is not a mass atrocity crime in and of itself, it has exposed deep divisions in American society. And I think that's what we were trying to respond to. And we were trying to respond to the fact that the mass protests and then the disproportionate use of violence against largely peaceful protesters were the kind of risks and the kind of warning signs that we see in different parts of the world and that we see as precursors to the sorts of identity-based conflicts which can result potentially ultimately in mass atrocity crime. So we were trying to respond to that. And also, I guess it has to be said, to the kind of calls of incitement from the President of the United States and the threat to use the military against unarmed protesters. These are things that we see in different parts of the world, and it never ends well. It's not a positive story. And so we thought it was necessary to say something about it.
You mentioned that the death of George Floyd in police custody does not constitute an atrocity crime. How would you define a mass atrocity or an atrocity crime?
Right. I mean, let's be absolutely clear. The death of George Floyd in police custody was atrocious. And, you know, I believe that it constituted murder. But a mass atrocity crime, these are crimes that are legally defined under international law. So we're talking about genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. And that single murder in and of itself did not constitute a mass atrocity crime. It was a gross, horrible, and egregious abuse of human rights. It was an extrajudicial killing by the officers involved, and they should be held fully accountable for that. But what we were talking more about is how that one death, how that one murder in police custody revealed deeper divisions in American society around racism, around inequality, around the militarization of policing. And these are all warning signs of much bigger conflicts that need to be confronted and overcome, or else they fester and they rot and they lead to much bigger problems.
One thing that has surfaced quite a bit recently are these images and videos of police officers attacking protesters, attacking peaceful, unarmed protesters. And a lot of this has taken place in New York City. These videos apparently show the New York Police Department attacking these unarmed, peaceful protesters. Watching those videos, what is your take or what is your opinion of the apparent actions of these police forces in the United States?
I think it's absolutely appalling. Here in New York, you know, crowd control measures have to be consistent with international standards. And that means that they have to strictly comply with principles of necessity, of proportionality, of legality, because we don't want to see any further deaths. We don't want to see any more injury. I've been down to a number of these protests. They are overwhelmingly peaceful. And so, you know, when I see those scenes of police beating people, of firing rubber bullets, of firing flashbangs and tear gas at people unnecessarily, or the terrible scene we saw last night in upstate New York, where a 75-year-old man was essentially pushed to the ground and his head was cracked on the pavement. And when you look at it, you can certainly explain away, you know, an individual act of aggression by, you know, a police officer, but that is not what's going on. There is clearly a pattern of violence, not only against protesters in many cases, but also against journalists, against anybody, it seems, that's trying to hold people accountable for their actions. And I think that, again, is something that is deeply disturbing. It's something that you see in authoritarian states in different parts of the world, and it's something that does not belong on the streets of the United States of America.
That was Simon Adams, Executive Director of the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect in New York. New details have emerged about the Ahmaud Arbery murder case. In February, 25-year-old Arbery was out for a morning jog in the U.S. state of Georgia when three white men used their trucks to chase him down before shooting him. A Georgia Bureau of Investigation agent testified Thursday that one of the men called Arbery a racial slur as he lay dying. Gregory McMichael, his son Travis McMichael, and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan have been charged with felony murder, but the new evidence may bring a federal hate crime charge as well. Arbery attempted several direction changes and even jumped into a ditch to avoid the men chasing him in their trucks. Ultimately, Travis McMichael shot Arbery three times. He claimed self-defense. No charges were filed against the three men until May 7th, 74 days after Arbery's death, and 2 days after video evidence of the shooting surfaced. This is VOA News. The U.S. military says it has conducted its first airstrikes against the Taliban in Afghanistan since a ceasefire between the insurgents and Afghan forces ended more than a week ago. Two assaults took place Thursday and Friday in Kandahar and Farah provinces and struck at Taliban operations, a military spokesman said in a Twitter post. The Post said the U.S. reiterates its position that, quote, all sides must reduce violence to allow the peace process to hold. The Post said the U.S. reiterates its position that, quote, all sides must reduce violence to allow the peace process to take hold, end quote. There was no immediate information on casualties from the airstrikes, and the Taliban had no immediate comment. The Taliban announced a three-day ceasefire to mark the Eid al-Fitr holiday, which ended May 26th. There has since been a decline in violence, and the Afghan government says it is ready to start peace talks with the insurgents. The U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban in February in which it pledged to withdraw all U.S. troops in return for security guarantees for Afghanistan. Human Rights Watch Friday said a Thai dissident has been abducted in Cambodia. The International Rights Organization says armed men snatched Wanchalarn Satsaksit off the street near his apartment building and drove him away in a black car. Cambodian authorities denied any abduction had taken place, and they are not investigating the allegation. The Thai government has accused him of violating the country's Computer Crime Act by running a Facebook page critical of the government. Thai authorities say they have no knowledge of his whereabouts. Over the last few years, at least 8 Thai exiles have been abducted in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, where they had fled after the 2014 coup in Thailand. Some of them were later found dead. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin. Cases of the novel coronavirus have topped 6.6 million worldwide, and Brazil now has the third highest number of deaths with more than 34,000. Brazil has the second highest number of COVID-19 cases with about 615,000. The United States has nearly 1.9 million cases with more than 108,000 deaths. The virus is now rapidly spreading in South America, even as new cases in Europe and Asia continue to decline. South Africa is seeing infection numbers start to rise as the country has eased restrictions. President Cyril Ramaphosa on Friday said he was particularly concerned about Western Cape Province, which has two-thirds of the country's 40,000 cases. The closely watched monthly report from the U.S. Labor Department showed the U.S. jobless rate dropped to 13.3% last month from 14.7% in April, despite the COVID-19 outbreak and widespread social unrest. The government said Friday that the economy added 2.5 million jobs in May, suggesting that thousands of stores, restaurants, gyms, and other companies reopened and rehired more quickly than many analysts had forecast. U.S. President Donald Trump hailed the report, calling it stupendous and joyous, though the U.S. unemployment rate remains near the highest levels since the Great Depression of the 1930s. Despite the new numbers and despite rescue packages of billions of dollars, major U.S. airlines are planning to cut more jobs as they struggle to cope with the impact of the coronavirus lockdown on the travel industry. For more, VOA's Miriam Diallo looks at how airlines are coping in the U.S. and around the world.
American and United Airlines plan to cut 30% of their management and support staff. Delta Airlines says it will extend early retirement and buyout offers to limit layoffs in the fall. These actions aren't surprising, says transportation expert Cliff Winston.
They're not flying the routes that they once flew. They've obviously cut back on their coverage. And at the same time, demand for their services dramatically down. So they need a lot less labor.
Author Volodymyr Bilotkach says 30% is a big cut, but notes the workforce has grown faster than the number of travelers in the past 5 years.
Over the last 5 years, actually, the U.S. airline industry added about 25% their workforce. So from 600,000 in March 2015 to around 750,000 in March 2020. And at the same time, I just looked at the passenger numbers. They have increased by about a bit more than 15%.
Under the payroll support program created through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, companies such as American Airlines will receive $5.8 billion in financial assistance, including grants and low-interest loans. United Airlines, approximately $5 billion. Delta Airlines, $5.4 billion. Southwest, $3.3 billion. In a statement, American Airlines said while the CARES Act money helped, the company needed to reduce its cost structure given it will be flying some 100 fewer planes in the summer than originally planned. Americans said this means it will need a leaner management and support staff team. Around the world, airlines have grounded about 15,000 jets and pressed some planes into cargo duty to earn revenue. In Addis Ababa, Ethiopian Airlines engineers were recently busy transforming some of their planes. Ethiopian Airlines recorded a loss of $550 million between January and April, but company CEO says he's optimistic.
We see some kind of maybe 50% recovery in the summer because it's a summer peak. And we see that people are sick and tired of the lockdown, as you can see in Europe and America. Governments are opening, even people are also going out.
EasyJet, the London-based budget airline, is also making cuts, up to one-third of its 15,000 employees. Several other airlines have filed for bankruptcy protection, including South African Airways, Virgin Australia, and the two largest carriers in Latin America, LATAM and Avianca. But this may not necessarily be a death sentence, says Winston.
They want a timeout. They want a chance to reorganize, try to get their finances in order, you know, have their creditors now wait and not have to get paid. And they want to forestall liquidation.
As the pandemic lockdown eases, experts say airline recovery will depend on many factors, especially on passenger confidence that they can fly again. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Police in Australia are setting up roadblocks to stop visitors heading to one of the country's most popular ski fields because of COVID-19 fears. Authorities say communities in the Kosciuszko National Park, about 500 kilometers south of Sydney, would be unable to cope with large numbers of tourists because of coronavirus concerns. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Usually a long weekend at the start of winter would prompt thousands of holidaymakers to head to the Kosciuszko National Park, home to Australia's highest mountain. It's popular with hikers, mountain bike riders and snow sports enthusiasts. Its three main ski resorts at Perisher, Charlotte Pass and Thredbo, though, remain in lockdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Park authorities say they would struggle to cope if there were a coronavirus outbreak and want visitors to stay away. Starting Friday, highways will be closed and police roadblocks will be put in place. Mick Pettit is from the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Service.
The concern is, and we've been talking to the emergency services, which includes also the local medicos, they're not prepared. We're not ready yet for a large influx of people. If, for example, there was a COVID outbreak, that would put the system under huge stress.
The official start of the ski season in New South Wales has been delayed until June 22, and many businesses fear they won't survive unless tourists can return sooner. Popular ski fields in the neighbouring state of Victoria also plan to reopen later this month. Officials are predicting a bumper season with significant snowfalls in the main resorts, although social distancing regulations will limit the number of activities on offer. Skiing is also popular in Tasmania. Australia is gradually winding back many of its COVID-19 restrictions, although many of its borders between states remain closed. Australia has had 7,240 confirmed COVID-19 cases. Most patients have recovered, but 102 people have died from the virus. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
European Union officials agreed Friday to end travel restrictions within Europe by the end of June, as the continent that was once the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak continues to lift public health measures. For more, I spoke to journalist Nicolas Pinault in Paris.
So today you had this huge conference, video conference, within the EU Commissioner for Home Affairs, Ylva Johansson, and all the EU Home Affairs ministers. So basically, they were talking about the idea of lifting restriction on internal borders because, you know, because of the pandemic, the whole Schengen area has been brought to a pause because basically each state reestablished controls at borders, and which is obviously not the real situation within Europe because you have free movement between citizens. So the idea was to meet today virtually to come to an agreement on how and when to lift those restrictions. And what is for sure is that the Schengen area, the full Schengen agreement, should be fully operational no later than the end of June. And you have some member states who are going to open their borders earlier by June 15th. But the whole idea within the ministers is to agree to lift the internal restriction by the end of June. That's what was said during the meeting. And on the other side, on the external borders, you have right now an extension of the closure. You have closures until the end of June, and they expect to come to a decision by the end of the month to maybe lift the closure of external borders by early July.
This is obviously something many people in Europe have been waiting for so they can do trade and travel, but there is also the issue of public health. Europe, of course, was the epicenter of this outbreak just a few months ago. Is there any pushback or concern that this is premature or that this may lead to a worsening of the coronavirus outbreak?
No, the overall picture is that efforts are working within the European Union, and the EU Commissioner Ylva Johansson was pretty optimistic about the outcome and the results right here to control the pandemic. Of course, you have some countries, and especially the UK, there's still a concern, but overall, the general situation within Europe is much better now, and we know that the pandemic has moved, and right now the center and the really concerning area will be maybe Latin America and mainly Brazil. So right now, people in the European Union are pretty optimistic about what's going on. But some states, they are, I would say, more cautious in their approach to reopen borders. And especially you have Austria, who still control citizens coming from Italy. And that's a concern for the Italian government. You have also other countries. They are not going to really reopen all their borders right now because of the touristic season. For example, Spain, which is pretty popular in Europe. For example, the Spain government would not reopen their borders for European tourists. Not until July 1st. So they're going to wait for the maximum. And some countries such as France, Greece, or Italy, they're going to lift restriction by June 15th. So you still see in Europe, they are still not talking with one voice. You still have some differences. But the overall goal is to lift the internal border restrictions by the end of the month.
The pandemic has hit a lot of European countries quite hard. There's been a very high death rate in Belgium, for instance, also in Spain and Italy. And also there is a high death rate in Sweden, which has used a very different approach from other European countries. It hasn't locked down in the same way as other European countries. Particularly in regard to Sweden, are there any different rules that will apply to them during the lifting of these travel restrictions?
As of right now, no. Again, they're going to, the idea, because they're part of the Schengen area and the EU blocs, that they're going to lift everything by the end of June. But as of right now, you have some concerns by Sweden's neighbors, such as Finland, Norway, or Denmark, and Norway is not in the EU. But you have some countries, they're concerned because basically they're trying to limit the movement from people coming from Sweden into their states. You have this concern right now, but the idea is that overall, you don't have as much hotspots, clusters that you would have in other countries, so it's still manageable for their neighbors.
That's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.